Our first 10-minute speaker is Meher.
Hi, Meher Alcoholic. So grateful to be here. I'll start with some stats. My sobriety date is March 27, 2014. I have a sponsor. I have the honor and privilege of sponsoring other women. I have been through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have an amazing home group, the Atlantic Group, which I'm so honored to speak at tonight. I know I'm going to run out of stuff, of time, so I just want to say a few things up front in case I don't get to at the end. I just want to welcome the newcomer. You know, my story in a nutshell, as I'll go through, is I drank for 2 decades. I was a hopeless drunk. I relapsed many, many times. Came into this group and relapsed many, many times. Many people here saw me come in and out. And then I'm so grateful because I finally was able to get it and I'm here and my life is completely different. And they talk about a life beyond your wildest dreams. And the reason is that when you come in here, you do not have the mental equipment to imagine what your life could be like. And that's kind of my story in a nutshell. But I do want to provide you with, you know, some insight into kind of what it was like. So, you know, I don't want to start right at the beginning, but I have to start at the beginning because this all started. I believe I was born with this disease. I had a horrible childhood, not because my parents, they were loving, they were wonderful, because I lived my entire childhood inside my head. And my head was awful. It told me things about myself. It told me I was horrible. It told me I didn't fit in. It told me I was less than. And, you know, I got to travel all over the world with my dad's profession. And instead of enjoying the experience, all I did was say, you know, how different I am. And so all I really wanted was to fit in. You know, I didn't like you. I knew you didn't like me, but I wanted your approval. I wanted to be like you. I wanted to dress like you. I just wanted to fit in. And I took this with me to college, and I saw in college that everybody was getting along, and the common factor was alcohol. So I thought, you know, so I picked up drinking, and, I never stopped. You know, I know now when I look back that I crossed that invisible line in college. Everybody else who was drinking with me was able to pick up and go to class, and I wasn't, because I know now that I have a disease, an allergy to alcohol, that when I pick it up and I start drinking, I cannot stop. So, I was busy. You know, I basically got my college degree in drinking and how to fit in. That was it. And, you know, when I graduated college, you know, I drank for another 15 years. And the story, you know, I can summarize, you know, I think, you know, it looked very much like probably a lot of stories here. You know, even at the end of college, I could have stopped and just come in the rooms. Like I was ready, but no, I wasn't done. So I continued. I started working. I got fired from a job. I started another job. I couldn't show up for it. I then took off. So I've got all kinds of things in my story. I landed up in India. And what did I do there? You know, I started to exercise self-will, which I thought would work very well. 10 months I would stay, off of alcohol, and then I would pick up again. And I would do this over and over. And now I'm visiting ERs. I'm going to psych wards. My poor parents, I'm killing them. They're getting on a flight every month to come see me, to pick me up off the floor, to clean up my vomit. You know, it just wouldn't end. The relationships that I damaged, just the kind of life that I lived, I don't understand now. I mean, you know, when I look back, it was a miserable life. And I think, you know, this is when, you know, God, for me, when I look back, God stepped in and, you know, he made it very clear what I was going to do. And I think we all talk about that window of grace that opens up. In my case, like God flung open the window. Like he was like, I am going to save you. I mean, this is literally like what I felt at that time. And I didn't know it yet because I hadn't come here yet. And he made it possible for me to come back to the U.S., the very U.S. that I'd run away from. And I knew that I was here to get sober. So the day after I landed, I went to an AA meeting and I got a sponsor and I started working the 12 step. I stayed sober for 10 months and then I relapsed. And I relapsed because I was lying to my sponsor about an inappropriate relationship. And so I wasn't being honest and I drank. I stayed out, and by the grace of God, I met my current sponsor, who was able to bring me to the Atlantic Group. And I came here, and I was like, wow, I'm definitely going to get it here. So we started working the steps again. And guess what? 9 months later, I relapsed again. And I thought at that point, you know, I'm a hopeless drunk. Thank you. 5 minutes left. I'm a hopeless drunk. I'm never going to get it. You know, I read in the book that there are people who are constitutionally incapable, and I thought I was one of those people. But my sponsor said, you know, pray to God to help you see the truth about yourself. Dig deeper. God will help you. And I did that. I prayed, and God helped me. Because when I wrote that fourth step this last time around, there was a whole bunch of things that came out that I didn't even know existed. And, you know, when I did that fifth step, you know, I now know that, you know, when I do my fifth step, I'm able to squeeze out all that shame, because I was living so long with this double life, the person that I showed to everybody else and the person that I really was. And there was everything in between. And I was able to squeeze that out in my fifth step. And there was so much there. And that took me into 6 and 7. And that's really when things started to, you know, that's when I had all these old, I had 39 years of old ideas about myself. I had no references really to trust. I didn't respect or love, or, you know, I didn't think I was capable of anything. And I took into 6 and 7, all these defects, and I was able to take contrary actions. And when I did that, there were different outcomes. And as a result of those different outcomes, things started to change. My life started to change. I had relationships, like everything started to open up. And I started to see the kind of life that I could have. And I started to see the kind of person that I could be, the person that God wanted me to be. And I wanted that. I wanted that. And I was hooked. And then I got to my amends. And I just want to share a little bit about my amends, because they're just, you know, again, God kind of bringing to me like his miracles. One of my first amends, you know, the first were all hunky-dory, everyone forgave me, and we were all holding hands and running in the meadows. And then the next one, you know, one of them, I got to this lady, and she, you know, I made amends, and then she told me I owed her a lot of money. So, you know, I was, okay, I don't know if I'm ready to do that. And I had to do a lot of work around it. You know, my sponsor helped me. She gathered other people. There were conferences over this, you know, and it was just ridiculous. And I had to write inventory. Thankfully, I was on the 10th step every day. Finally, I became willing to make that amends. I made that amends, or started to set up those monthly payments. About 6 months into it, I suddenly came into some money randomly. One of my investments in India did well. I was able to take that money, put a down payment, and buy an apartment in New York City. It has nothing to do with the apartment. It has everything to do with me becoming willing to make that amends and making it. My sponsor tells me it's an astronomical relationship. You cannot do the math with what happens here. You cannot do the math with what God can do for you. Another amends I want to talk about is the living amends that I was able to make to my parents. A couple years into my sobriety, my dad fell sick. He went into hospital struggling with some of the same issues that I have. And I was able to last minute jump on a flight and fly to India go be there for my mom to help her through the situation. When the plane touched down, I burst into tears, because I was able to go show up for my parents. My parents were gotten on numerous flights within India, from India to the US. I would go missing for 3 days. They would call my sponsor, they would call my friends, and I was able to do this. And it's just one instance that I was able to do it. But it's just a gift and a miracle. And I started to see again, you know, the kind of person or the kind of life or how I could get to show up for other people. And so, you know, that's just how it's been. You know, I have this big, beautiful life today. It's full of wonderful people that I care about, that I get to show up for. You know, I have defects that crop up all the time. Don't get me wrong. They do. And 1 minute left. Thank you. And I still have those voices in my head, as I did as a little girl, but now I have a God, and I have a toolbox, and I know that I'm not alone, and I know that I don't need to seek approval anymore from anyone or from anything. I have to remind myself that I have a God, and the only thing and person that I need to seek approval from is God, and my God loves me, because why else would he give me this life? I am eternally grateful for my sobriety, and thank you all, and thank you for allowing me to be of service.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Wyatt.
Hello, I'm Wyatt. I'm an alcoholic. I got sober June 21st, 2014. My sponsor is Greg, and I'm working steps 9 through 12. So I guess I'll tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I grew up in Connecticut, raised in a fairly like a normal childhood, happy family, nothing wrong. Parents didn't drink too excessively. But I guess like I noticed that they're having a good time when they drank, and it was like a very alluring thing to like have this thing out there that I couldn't have, but made them very happy. And that's always kind of how I viewed it from a young age. And it was always something that like I definitely wanted to participate in. And there was also a lot of resentment around like not being able to have that. Like, why can you have that? Why can't I have that? And like, so I would like sneak drinks in my family's liquor cabinet. But I guess I would say like the first time I got drunk, I was with a few friends, and we stayed up until their parents went to bed, and we started just pounding shots. And it was, I remembered like two, like probably 5 to 10 minutes of it, and immediately blacked out. And I woke up the next morning, and I was in a pile of my own vomit and urine on the couch. My friends were somewhere else. I didn't really know where they were. And then I kind of, I like flipped the cushion of their couch and threw out the shirt and just said, I like lost the shirt. I need another shirt. And then they're like, oh yeah, no problem. And I got away out of that situation fine. And that was kind of what made it more attractive, is like, okay, like that's, I don't know. I had a great night and I didn't get caught. And that's kind of how I tried to get all of my drinking in. But unfortunately I wasn't a very good alcoholic. And I would just get caught continuously by my parents, and I was put into therapy and IOP sessions from a very early age. This is like freshman year in high school, and my parents were on top of me, and I would like push back against them, and I always thought it was like, this is my time, like I'm entitled to have this experience, like my friends are doing it, everyone's doing it around me, why are you being so hard on me? And I like continued to drink and experiment with other drugs, and like every single time I'd get caught, and then I'd be getting drug tested and all this stuff. And so it came up to this summer, and they said like, oh, you need to pass this drug test or we're sending you away. And I failed that drug test, and then I was like escorted out of my basement to a therapeutic like community in the woods where we'd hike, and I actually was exposed to the 12 steps for the first time. And but I didn't really care, like it was just like me trying to push back against my parents and be like, no, I'll be fine, like you guys are just helicopter parents, like I have no problems. But I was like starting to ask like questions about it, and a lot of people said that they related to like the story that I already had, and said that like I was probably an alcoholic. And so I went to a year-long program, but I need to shorten this story up and kind of get into sobriety. So I went to a year-long program, and I was getting in trouble. I was getting into relationships, just trying to distract myself, like when I couldn't have alcohol in my system. And so I got kicked out of that place, and I got sent home. And my parents were going through a hard time, and they were in the process of a divorce. I wasn't really being paid attention to anymore. And so I could actually drink how I wanted to drink. And I'd go out every night. I'd sneak out no matter what. I just carelessly would take their liquor now, because they never confronted me about it. They were too busy with their own struggle. And the whole time that they were getting a divorce, I didn't necessarily care about them. I didn't care about me having a different life or anything about that. It was, I could drink a little bit more now because they're so distracted, and it's an excuse. People will feel bad for me, and they'll feel bad for me. And I met a girl, and she, I hung out with her all the time, and I tried to stay at her place more than my parents, because that was a mess. And I started to make a lot of mistakes in that relationship that kind of like affected me and actually made me realize that like I didn't have as much control over this drinking thing as I thought. Like I'd break up with her in blackouts and I'd embarrass her in front of her friends and all this stuff. And I really didn't want to act that way. And it was really demoralizing when she would like tell me the stories of the day after. And I started to like really get down on myself. And I'd start blacking out. I was blacking out a lot with like the combination of things I was using. And it was really apparent to my, it started becoming really noticeable to my mom because I would take the Metro North straight to New Haven and she'd have to come find me. I was basically incapacitated outside the train station. And she actually later mentioned these instances as like some of the scariest moments in her life, because this was the dead of winter. It was like a series like of like 2 or 3 months where I'd black out and she'd have to find me like 2 or 3 times a month during the winter. And so that really affected her, and that also scared me. And all of that kind of built up to the second intervention, where I was just going into therapy as I usually was, and there all of a sudden is my mom, my sister, and my girlfriend. And I didn't really pay attention to what anyone was saying. I was just like infuriated that my girlfriend would betray me like this. How could she? And that I kind of like just fumed over that in the car ride up, and the driver actually looked back at one point and he said, "Oh, you must be relieved." And that actually changed my perspective a little bit. And I was like, well, I'm not embarrassing myself every night. I'm not stealing people's drugs. I'm not, you know, taking their liquor, or people aren't calling me a mooch anymore. And there was like a lot of things where I was like, okay, maybe this is a little bit of a new start for me. And then also I knew that my girlfriend wouldn't stay with me if I was not going to get sober. So those are a few things going into this first rehab that I was thinking about. And I actually thought about giving it a try for the first time. That was like my fourth institution. And I never really considered me trying to do anything like getting sober before. This was, so I was like, oh, I'm going to give it a shot. And I really, that was the mindset that I went in with. And I listened at the meetings, and I also wanted to make it up to my parents. There was a strong feeling of guilt that like this time it's going to be different. This time I'm not going to get in trouble every 2 weeks. They're not going to be disappointed in me. And just like the guilt was just really piling up, and I just wanted to change what I was doing. So I guess the first concept that I really tried to nail down was the concept of God. And they really stressed the importance of God in this, and in relation to this program at this first rehab that I went to. And I wanted to, it was almost like a competition. I wanted to get it before anyone could get it, because all these people who had been to jails and really what I thought destroyed their lives. But I could also see myself in their shoes, but I wanted to do it better than they did. And so I talked to one of the, religious members at this organization and just asked him like, hey, what's up with prayer? How do you do this? And he was like, oh, it doesn't have to be fancy. You don't have to like recite any special prayers. Like, how about you just say like thank you at night and throw your shoes under the bed, and then thank you in the morning when you pick your shoes up, when you get on your knees to pick your shoes back up from under the bed. And it really kind of like my program launched from that point. I went through this inpatient program and then was offered to go to a recovery house in New Haven, Connecticut. And that was like a little bit of a change in my story, where I didn't push back. It wasn't about me getting home to do what I always did and hanging out with the same people and chasing all the wrong things. It was about me actually starting strong and like potentially getting a new start at this. And when I got to this new place, there was a lot of, immediately I could tell that this wasn't an environment like I'd been in before, where like people would be sneaking drugs and like trying to, you know, like beat the system. It was like a lot of young men who wanted to get sober and who were really motivated, who talked to their every day. And I kind of sailed through the steps and ended up working for that rehab afterwards. And I guess I'll just like do a little brief thing today. I mean, this program is unbelievable. And like these, the people who are getting sober and who are newcomers at this, in during this time are really inspiring to me because I said, like, it was that community that really carried me through. And it's just great to like hear about people who are new in this program, who are on Zoom, who are logging in every day. I'm actually working with a guy who's, he's got 30 days and he's been doing this the whole time. And this program gave me the opportunity to graduate school. I just graduated this year and it was something that I wasn't capable of doing before. I couldn't motivate myself to get to class and I didn't have the work ethic that this program instilled in me to complete any coursework or homework or anything like that. So, and then also just like a miracle of this program is the amount that I care for other people in this program and also the amount that I care for my family. I felt kind of void and vapid in relation to my family. I didn't necessarily care what happened with my extended family or even my close family. And this program gave me the gift back of like truly and sincerely caring for people and deeply feeling it and trying to do my best to be there for them in hard times. And this has been a perfect opportunity for that. And it's really a gift from God. So with that, I will finish. Thank you.
As was said, this meeting is open to anyone. However, we are an anonymous fellowship and ask that what you hear and whom you see remain here. Our main speaker tonight is Amanda.
Hi, I'm Amanda. I'm an alcoholic. Sorry, it took me forever to unmute. I'm so excited to be here. Someone text me if it gets loud. Or my connection just doesn't work. But I want to thank Rich for asking me to speak. It's a real honor and privilege. I love this group. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love every single one of you. It's so nice to see all the everyone on Zoom, whether your face is there or not, or your name. It's just it's a connection that I love and is priceless. My sobriety date is July 30th, 2000. Atlantic Group is my home group. Stephanie's my sponsor. Steps 10 through 12. I sponsor, I have service commitments, and it's basically the same thing I've been doing over and over again since I came in. And I have a life that is just, my life is shocking is what it is. I don't understand it. I don't quite deserve it. I was joking with Stephanie, the line about an hour ago, it works if you work it and you're worth it. And I was just like, and I'm worth it, which is shocking that I think that. What I love about AA is that it's straightforward. And my story is pretty straightforward. And, you know, that line in the book that I love that is so crystal clear is, you know, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely or in drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. And that is my story. When I started drinking, at 15. I stopped when I was 20. It was a brief career, but it was 5 years of crashing and burning my life and everyone around it. And I didn't mean to do. I didn't mean to do it. It's like, oops, I didn't mean to do it. And the first thing before I even got into AA, I didn't know the definition of alcoholism. I learned it when I got here, and. But when I look at my drinking story, right from the beginning, I had little control over the amount I take when I started drinking. I took a drink and it was just, that was it. I didn't ease into alcoholism. It was like, it was there, it was ready for me. And I showed up with the booze. And I describe it as my very first drink was a breath of air. It was oxygen. I didn't know it was wound a little tight. I didn't know I needed to be unwound. But when I took a drink, I realized how wound up I was. And that drink made me feel better. And drinking makes me feel better. It's unfortunate that the physical allergy exists because a lot of damage took place. But at the time that I picked up a drink, my parents were going through a really bad divorce. I was very confused and dealing with my sexuality. I knew the answer, but I wasn't happy with it. I was gay and I was not happy with it. And I was closeted and hid it. Everything around me was falling down. It is not the reason I picked up a drink, and it wasn't the reason that I was feeling bad. I've learned that through all of the step work. Because when I look back at it, like my brother went through the same things, minus the gay, the homosexuality. He didn't drink himself almost to death. You know, he dealt with it differently. And it was just like my externals have nothing to do with my alcoholism. Basically, I picked up at 15. I ended up in my first AA meeting when I was 16. I got caught drinking in school. I thought it was brilliant to start drinking in school because I wouldn't get caught by my parents. This was the thinking, like if I drink in school, my mother won't find out because my mother was going to kill me. So I drank in school and it worked for a couple of times. And then I got caught drinking in school and they called my mother and I didn't follow all the way through with that thought. And they called my mother and I played, you know, and rightly so. I mean, part of it was true. Part of it was I was being dishonest, but I played the divorce card. I played the broken home card. I did not get kicked out of school. I did not get suspended, but I got sent to therapy, which was a blessing in disguise because that therapist sent me to an AA meeting when I was 16 years old. She talked to me about my drinking before she suggested it. She said that, you know, if you think that you're alone, that people aren't understanding the way that you feel, it's like, I have a place for you. And then she handed me the Nassau County AA list, which was like, this is, it was devastating. It was like, it was a little weird. I was 16 years old. So it was not supposed to, it's not in my cards. But I went, and I don't remember much of it, but that night, but I knew that something was up with my drinking. So something happened in that meeting. I didn't quite understand it. I didn't say a word to anyone, but I knew that something was off with my drinking. And I left. I went to a friend's house. All my friends were drinking in the basement, and I white knuckled it at 16. And white knuckling meant I sat in my friend's kitchen while everyone was drinking in the basement, eating popcorn shrimp and trying to avoid the whole thing. And I hate shrimp, but I needed something to do. And then I left. And then the next night I went to the party and I drank and I felt so much better. You know, that night where I was white knuckling, it was terrible. The next night I felt much better. And then I just dismissed AA and just carried on. And I went to, I graduated from high school. I got into college and went to college in the Bronx. It was awesome because it was, you know, booze was everywhere. And I didn't have to worry about it. I looked like I was 12. I looked like I was 12 for a very long time. You know, it was great in one respect, but it's terrible when you want to buy alcohol, especially on Long Island. But when you get to the Bronx, everything's yours. And I was just off to the races. And you know, I have the war stories. I'm a fall down drunk. I broke bones. I cracked my head open. I'm also very promiscuous. I woke up with strangers in strange places. You know, and in the beginning it was hilarious. And at the end of it, it was just the incomprehensible demoralization. I did it again. You know, that disease of progression that the book talks about, Bill's story, I think does it perfectly, where alcohol ceased to be a luxury, it became a necessity. You know, I would wake up the next morning, I would still be very drunk, except fully aware of what was going on. And I wanted it to stop so bad. I knew it was directly related to the drinking, but I could not figure out how to stop it. And I had friends that were trying to tell me something's wrong with your drinking. They would ask, why can't you just have a few and get buzzed? And my answer was like, I have no idea. I have no idea. And my mom, I dragged her through the ringer. It's heartbreaking, but at the end of my drinking, the way that I just got myself into a lot of trouble, and my mother was contacted multiple times from hospitals and from police, and my father had to get involved, and my aunts and uncles, and they were devastated. And here my mom was this just incredibly strong woman, and I went home on spring break. It was 3 months before I got sober. I went into her drawer to grab socks because I didn't have any. I'm a college kid. I don't blame my alcoholism. I was a college kid and I don't have socks. So I went to go get socks and I found a prescription for anti-anxiety medication from my mother. And I just started crying. But like any good alcoholic, I took half of them and then left and went to a party and drank and took all the pills. Because that was my best. That was my best. And she never figured it out. And so, you know, what was also getting worse was the intervals between my drinking when I was this, my brief sober intervals were now also filled with panic attacks, the shakes. I couldn't look at anyone in the eye. It was anxiety, but it was just an incredible fear of people. And I would leave my dorm room. I would go to class. I was playing soccer. I went to soccer practice and went to the soccer game and I went back and that was it. I couldn't deal with life sober. It was just terrifying. And the panic attacks were getting worse. Everything was getting worse. I was having night sweats. It was just getting worse. And that was becoming unbearable. And then I would drink, I'd get some reprieve, but I'd sober up and I'd have to deal with it again. And I would do something stupid when I was drinking. I would upset somebody. And so I started looking for a quick fix on the internet. And I found an online sponsorship list. It wasn't related to AA, but you can email people. And it was like perfect because I couldn't call anyone. I couldn't talk to anyone. In fact, when in school, how I managed it was if you needed my phone number for whatever reason, I gave you my suite mates and you would call three different rooms, screen the calls, and then it would get to me and I would decide if I was calling you back. And so I emailed this woman. She had 9 years of sobriety and she emailed me back and forth. She basically 12-stepped me and never mentioned AA. She waited for me and I was still drinking through the whole thing. And she waited for me to say, how do you get sober? How do you stay sober? And she dropped what I call the AA bomb. It was terrible news. She was like, I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 9 years. And I suggest that you go to an AA meeting. And that was terrible news. And the woman lived in Philadelphia, so she couldn't really come with me. Plus she never met me. And I think that was crazy. And, but she suggested it. I went, I dragged my poor friend with me, who's not an alcoholic. God bless the non-alcoholic friends. I went, I hated it. I went home, I drank. I woke up the next day and then I found myself at my, you know, and it's fuzzy. That night, my last drink was one beer. And it was at my brother's house. I drank one beer. I started to crack into the second one. I just took the top off. And then I realized that like, I'm just, you know, heading down, nothing's changing. Nothing's changed. And if I had any chance of getting any better, I'm just gonna try AA because that is the last stop for me. And I went back to an AA meeting. What I did differently was I put my hand up. I said I had 3 days. I don't know if I waited. I got attacked by a bunch of women, which was terrifying. But thank God for them. This one woman passed me a note, said, meet me at a meeting tomorrow. And, you know, how to communicate with me in early sobriety was passing notes. And that worked for a really long time because I was not talking. She passed me a note. I followed her around. It was in between my sophomore and junior year. I was on Long Island. I got 14 days together following that woman around, not saying a word to her. And then I had to go back to school for preseason. This woman that I met online in Philadelphia, she was talking to me daily. She became like an interim sponsor. She was guiding me to go to meetings. Once I got to school, I was ahead to head into the city, put my hand up. I went to Chelsea Riverside, I put my hand up. Another woman, Maria, many of you know her. She was a member of our group, passed me a note. I got attacked by women and she passed me a note. She said, I know a great meeting on the East Side, 60th and Park tomorrow at 7 p.m. I met her there and she became my first sponsor. And she was very energetic and I loved it and I loved her. She had the energy for the both of us because I was dying inside and it was great. She didn't drag me through. I was willing to do everything, but she had the enthusiasm to carry us both. And God bless sponsorship. We need the sponsors to be a little bit more enthusiastic than the sponsee. And it was great. I was painfully shy. I still couldn't talk, but what I could do is I wasn't going to fellowship and I wasn't calling you, but what I could do step work and I can write, I can read and I can write my step work. And that's what I did. And I got to my fourth and my fifth step and I opened up a little bit. At the same time, some of you know Zilka, she now lives in Germany. I got sober with Zilka. And Zilka came, I think she was like brand spanking newly sober and she came to the US. she became my very first friend, and it was perfect. She was my only, she was, it was her and this woman, Leona. But Soka was great because her English was good, but it wasn't great. And hanging out with her meant I did not have to answer questions. And we had the best relationship. And I would pick her up and I would drive her home. We went to the Bill W. dance together, you know, and we got sober together, and it was a perfect relationship. And then we had, there was this other woman, Leona, that she did a lot of the talking. You know, it just worked out. And I needed time. The other thing is I walked around with baseball hats. I went to Fordham in the Bronx. The initials were FU. The hats at the time said FU. I had multiple FU hats, and that's what I wore. And I remember when I started to see the changes, my FU hats came off after my fifth step, and I started saying hi to people and started talking a bit more. I got to my ninth step of Ben's. I ultimately switched to Stephanie, who is still my sponsor today, when I had about a year, and Stephanie's been guiding me through for 19 years. And I don't even know where to begin to describe the recovery that takes place with her. And I started to make my ninth step amends, and I started the sponsoring. The shift in my recovery, where a lot of the self-centered fear went away, and I had really super low self-esteem. I don't think I had any, but we'll just say that it was low. It started to build through, honestly, sponsoring other people and going to big book studies and just being really involved in AA. My confidence grew, my self-esteem grew. I became a little bit more comfortable in my skin, and I was in the middle of it. Eventually I graduated, I had to go into the working world, and every skill that I brought to that working world came from my recovery. And this, you know, the, thank you, Deborah. And it was how to relate to other people is basically what it was. How do I not run from people when they terrify me? My relationships with my family, I have a really tight family, but the divorce was pretty rough. I had a lot to clean up with my mom. I had a lot to clean up with my dad. My mom was a little easier because I'm a mama's girl. And when they got divorced, my dad left, my brother left, and I went with my mom. So that was pretty easy. My dad was really difficult, and that relationship has taken years to heal. I had to make more than one amends because I kept screwing it up. I disappeared, and I scared the living daylights out of him, and that was the amends. And I'd make the amends, and then in sobriety, I would disappear and scare the living daylights out of him. And I did that about four times. So I had four amends. Where the relationship started to repair is that I had to connect with him at a common level. And he loved scuba diving, and he called me up and was like, "Do you want to go scuba diving?" And I'm like, "If you're paying, I would love to go scuba diving." And we went scuba diving. We took our lessons together. We got certified all the way to, I think rescue diving was the last one we got. And we went on these crazy scuba trips, and they were phenomenal because you don't have to talk, you're under the water. And we were diving about four times a day, and under the water, there was no talking. And then when you came up, you were so tired to talk. But we were having moments through those vacations. Eventually I had to start paying, but I was willing to go and pay. And our relationship started to develop, not in the way I thought it should heal, you know, not in this close, open, I'm going to tell you everything about everything in a way. It healed on an even playing field. He had a lot of opinions about Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't, you know, I told him I was in AA. He thought it was the end of the world. And he had a lot of things, and I just didn't argue, and I just kept showing up. And I really love this story, and I know people have heard it, but he was very much against AA. He didn't understand why I had to go, why I was still going. You know, those friends in AA, blah, blah, blah. I had seven or eight years of sobriety. He remarried, and my stepbrother and his wife were suffering really bad from alcoholism, and they were of Russian descent. I think they have great English, but everybody says that they don't. And my dad called me up one day, and he's like, "I watched AA work for you for 8 years. Do you think it can work for your stepbrother and his wife?" You know, and I was like, "Yeah." And I showed up a day later You know, Arena from our group helped me get a bunch of Russian literature for them. My stepbrother did not stay sober, but his wife did, and she's doing really well. Where I love AA and where we just rally around each other and there for each other is that Arena from my group helped immensely. But where I got to watch is where she helped my father, because my dad was really struggling. And my dad, when I was drinking, my dad was not around as much, and he didn't really suffer from the direct impact from my alcoholism, but he was here and he couldn't understand it and he couldn't grasp it. And so while Arena was helping my stepbrother's wife, she was also talking to my dad and explaining things in his language where he could get his head around it. And she had to do it and I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it because I'm too close. I'm still the daughter. And I just, I'm not the one to do it. And she did it. And my dad, even today, talks about her and is so incredibly grateful to her, as am I. And, you know, basically what I have, I don't even know, I'm just overwhelmed. I'm overwhelmed with AA, it happens. And I don't know what crying looks like on Zoom, so I'm not going to do it. The things that I did coming in are the same things I do today. The longer I stay sober, and God willing, next week I'll have 20 years. I turned 40 earlier this month. I didn't think I would celebrate 40 and 20 like this. I had a lot of scenarios in mind. I totally missed this one. I like to cover all my bases and completely did not think of a pandemic. But I'm loving every bit of it. And I am shocked about, even to this day, what AA I think quietly does to the alcoholic, provided we implement a few spiritual principles and work our steps continuously. You know, that 10, 11, 12, that 10 step, that's just 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 over and over and over again. It never ceases to amaze me. And then passing that on to the still sick and suffering alcoholic. The thing I think, you know, in my sobriety, I've had some great things and then I've had some struggles, right? I had to come out in sobriety. That was like not fun. I totally understand why people don't do it sober. That just totally sucked. And I had a lot of people with a lot of opinions in my family, but I had the backing of Stephanie and I had the backing of some incredible friends. I see Kelly on. Kelly constantly makes me laugh and we're in a meeting together. She just did it again tonight. But I had like the support. You know, and then, you know, we've had deaths. We've had a number of deaths in my family. We've had a number of issues in my family, and the fellowship just wraps around you. You know, and there's a, you know, I think Rajesh said it once, and it's never left. You know, we have one foot in the fellowship and one foot in God. And when you can't feel God and when you can't see God and when my relationship is a little shaky for one reason or another, I have the fellowship to carry me, you know, and when I'm feeling strong and I have that connection and I have that relationship, I can carry my fellowship, you know, and it, you know, 10:11 talks about it, but that becomes this, like this unshakable foundation of sobriety. Sobriety is, you know, I have a lot of gifts, but I don't, you know, I have a 2 and a 4 year old, so it's a little wild right now. I have a dog that's very reactive to them. He gets very upset. He is also a child and I think needs a little help. You know, I have a wife, we have a house, we have the 2 cars, we have a job. We have like this incredible life, but I also have a bunch of alcoholics in my family that have even more than that, right? And so I don't call these things as gifts of sobriety. They weren't promised to me when I got sober. What was promised to me was a relationship with God that will allow me to enjoy whatever's in front of me, enjoy my kids. You know, there's the 10, 11, and 12, especially in the 11th step, it talks about discipline. We let God discipline us. You know, and what I found is that there is freedom in the discipline. If I stay disciplined and I take these certain steps to take time out of my day to do all these things, I am now free to enjoy that joy, what's in front of me. Some of the things that I have, you know, a lot of you know, I am now going to law school at night, which was a dream of mine for a very, very long time. And I was told it's like a Hallmark story. Not really, because I'm not worthy of a Hallmark story. But like, I had a lot of people saying like, you know, I don't know how well you'll do. You know, I had a lot of those, and those voices stayed with me. I think they said them when I was like a kid, and you know, like a good alcoholic, I'm going to hold on to what you said to me when I was 8. You know, you don't think like one, you know, and then I got in, and then I'm just like, I'm shockingly doing really well. But what I walked into with that is, anything you put before your sobriety, you're going to lose. And that was something that was taught to me when I first came in. And that has been resonating with me all through this. And it is true. And I don't want to test it. And it is true. And what happens is when I'm working really, really hard, I can now go to class and really, really concentrate and focus. And when I work really, really hard in AA, I can now go focus on my kids and have fun with them. You know, this experience being on, you know, with the Zoom meetings and everything like that, what someone read this in a meeting the other day, and I loved it because I was getting a lot of phone calls at the beginning about all this stuff, about are we doing the right thing, blah, 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 blah. But I took such comfort. It was in As Bill Sees It, and there was a line that says, it seems proof that AA can stand on its own feet anywhere and under any condition. And then further down, it says, AA has reached enough spiritual maturity to know that its dependence is upon God. You know, and when we look at traditions and we apply them, we take those traditions and we apply them to our own personal life. It's just like, if we are working this program, if I'm applying these principles, if I'm doing everything I can, I am also going to be able to withstand any condition because my dependence is upon God and not any other person. And I've learned that in this environment. This environment has come true. It was an adjustment. But if we have, again, if we have fellowship, one foot in the fellowship and one foot in God, we'll get through everything and anything. Same as our group and same as AA. Stephanie moved to Ohio. I forgot, I think it was a year or two ago, which was great because then she started me sending me literature about the Four Absolutes, and I love the Four Absolutes and all the Ohio and Akron, you know, and then me, the proud New Yorker, you know, the proud AA New Yorker versus the proud Akron, you know, whatever, but I love AA history. And I do love the Four Absolutes. And just today, you know, and I'm going to end with this just to show that I'm like not, you know, I don't have this. I'm just another alcoholic that could get drunk again if I don't continue this. And I got stuck on a resentment. I got stuck in a fear. I got stuck in a fear at work. Fear of what people think of me, fear of, you name it. It just, you know, it just spiraled. And I started writing and I quit. The writing, it wasn't coming. And then I remembered Stephanie sent me this pamphlet about the Four Absolutes and asked myself some questions. And I couldn't get to the solution and to God's voice through the questions in the book. And I got there through the Four Absolutes. And what it came to me in the writing was that, like, if I tackle everything with a spirit of love and service, there is no fear. There's nothing I have to worry about. And that's how I tackled today. And it was a good day when I'm putting those principles as my purpose. I have 5 minutes left and I'm a big fan of ending early. I just want to say I love all of you, and Rich, you're doing a great job. Thank you for letting me speak.
My name's Rich and I'm an alcoholic and I chair the Atlantic Group. Let's thank tonight's speakers, Maher, Wyatt, and Amanda. You have heard a typical virtual AA meeting. We hope you return and bring a friend.